Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It's always a challenge to chair whatever session after lunch because people are sleepy. And I'm afraid that some of our participants maybe also lost their way and maybe they will join us slightly later. We'll see. Anyhow, we have nice round table panel. And today we talked about Brexit, we talked about budgetary challenges and the other challenges of the European Union, but it seems to me the word trade has not been mentioned or
Estonians.
Ah, Estonians. Okay, maybe in that time I was thinking about anything else. Anyhow, the trade war or trade crisis or this sort of wording I have not heard today. But I mean that our session is very timely because indeed the European Union is confronted with many different challenges and crises and trade wars and potential response of the European Union to this challenging situation. It's really a very big issue and a very big challenge. I don't think I should remind you that trade is extremely important for the development of any country and any union of countries. The European Union is now confronted indeed with the trade crisis because the world trading system is generally under attack. And as we can hardly imagine the European Union existing just with intra-trade, that means that we should in the European Union somehow to adjust to the situation and to take to work on the potential response. And actually the aim of our session, in my view, is to discuss exactly this potential response. We have three distinguished speakers perhaps I will first introduce you. On my left, it's Peter Balázs, Ambassador Balázs, and also Professor of International Trade. Peter is my colleague since I was working for the European Commission. That was since 2005. For a number of years, Peter was Deputy Director General of DG Trade. I mean, he is exactly the person who, by his education, by his experience, and by his engagement in the EU matter, is really fit to the purpose of our session. On my right, it's colleague from Italy, Dr. Ettore Greco. Ettore is Executive Vice President of the Institute of Foreign Affairs. I was looking at his CV, and it seems to me that the key words which I drafted for myself, it's multilateralism and global governance program. Ettore was working also as a journalist, as a freelancer, but later as a correspondent for the Economist Intelligence Unit. The third speaker of the panel is our guest from Estonia, from Tartu. He's fellow on Russian strategic and military studies right now. Okay, if we are talking about trade wars, we indeed need somebody who is expert on military studies. Dr. Willier Weibel, I pronounce correctly, Dr. Willier Weibel, he actually has very different experience in research on many different topics, so not only on Russia, not only on defense, and not only on military studies. He's expert on competitiveness issues, and I think that his contribution from his various aspect and viewpoint would be very topical and constructive. Now, as I said, the final goal of our session is indeed to find the answer to the very big question how European Union should respond. But when I have analyzed as the biggest challenges and the biggest issues for the European Union, I came to the conclusion that there are three major issues, and I will ask these questions to the panelists, and I think that they will be able to give the concise answers. So my first question is, can the World Trade Organization be reformed? And what kind of tactics should be expected from the European Union? The second question, is a new normal the United States skepticism about the trade system? What should be strategic response of the European Union? And the third question is about China. Is China willing and able to implement reforms needed to address the concerns of its main trading partners? What do we expect from the EU at the EU-China summit, which is in the coming days on 9th April? So this is the topics and the issues which I hope we all together will be able at not to answer maybe, but at least to approach to some answers. So I will give you 7-8 minutes for response, and we will start with Peter.
Thanks very much, Inna. Thanks for this opportunity to be here. And this is really a very timely discussion, and it's timely also that this morning, at least the first session was about the political issues, political and security issues. And I think that it is not an exaggeration to say that we are living unprecedented times in many respects, but one of the unprecedented times is the very close interrelationship between politics and economics, or if you want, politics and trade, much more than was the case according to my memories, and I deal for a long time with these issues for several decades. I also read with interest the prologue for our meeting prepared by Madame Kleinberger. I agree with many of what you wrote, but not with everything, to be frank. But I will try to at least to say that how I see the things. First of all, and perhaps this is a kind of intervention, but I think that as ex-commission official, I cannot avoid pointing this out, that everywhere this morning, also in the prologue, we have heard that Brussels decides. Mm. And Brussels decided this or that. Now, we discussed also with Inna several times, and apparently this is not in the public knowledge, how the European Union actually works. There is one area where Brussels really decides, and that is competition. State aid and mergers. Mm-hmm. On everything else, on the smallest issues, member states alone in the council or the European, together with the European Parliament, can decide. Even on delegated acts, even on issues which are where the Commission is executing it, but everything has to be taken to the member states. And the brave national politicians, sorry to say, if there is a good decision, they go home and say, we fought it, it's our success. If the decision is in which they participated and possibly also voted for in Brussels. They go home, Brussels forced us this to do. This so much about, but this is politics, of course, but this is the way it works. Now, turning immediately, however, to the substantive questions. I would in spite of my very long association with the Commission, and I have spent altogether 9 years in Geneva working on WTO issues as national representative, last as ambassador, I have to tell you that, and this is first I start with the second part of the question, what kind of tactics should be expected from the European Union? The European Union's tactics, and it's not just tactics, but policy, is also in the trade area, to be based on the rule of law, on the respect of international norms and international agreements, in this case the WTO, but you could say the OECD, which has also norms, and there are a number of other agreements, and this is what the EU is continue to represent these days, trying to find allies in under very, very challenging conditions, which is linked to the second question, to the United States' present policies, which are the antithesis in everything what the EU does and believes in. I will still come back to it. Now, starting from this, when the question arises whether the WTO can be reformed, I am unfortunately skeptical, and I tell you why. Not just because of Trump, but because when it comes to the WTO, its crisis didn't start recently. I participated during the Uruguay round negotiations, the last successful round of the first GATT, which led to the formation of the World Trade Organization. And already a few years after the completion of the round, in the late 90s, the United States had an increasingly skeptical view towards the WTO. You could say it buyer's regret or buyer's remorse. And this was linked to the WTO dispute settlement system. The WTO disputes are normally at that time decided before the Uruguay round by a panel, but it was up to the member states to decide whether they accept execute the decisions of the panel or not. From the Uruguay round onwards, there was no such possibility anymore. There was a second level of the decisions, and the decisions became immediately executable in the form of trade retaliation. If a country did not meet the obligations and did not fulfill its commitments, which were found to be legally correct, then the country whose interests were the complainant, whose interests were affected, had the right for retaliation, equivalent to the damage suffered. Now, this was unacceptable for the US because they considered that, first of all, the US, as the largest country of the world, cannot accept as a principle anywhere that there is a higher authority, and there is no other international court which can work as the WTO works, that without the agreement of the losing country, there can be legal and economic consequences of having lost. And therefore, they started, especially in anti-dumping questions, to regularly disrespect the decisions of the WTO. Trump only gave the final push to this effort, even during Obama's time, during the to Bush's time. This was already the case that the U.S. was increasingly skeptical. But turning immediately to the second question, Trump still brought a qualitatively new approach. If you put together whatever he tweeted this is his way of communications and his personal views, so that there can be no explanation that this is not what he thinks. He calls himself a tariff man, but that he believes in the force of tariffs, but I would even simplify it even more. In Trump's belief, if any country has a trade surplus against the US, it is possible only through cheating. The US is the largest, and in his view, the most competitive country of the world. And if a country consistently can export more to the US than the other way around, then it must be achieved through hidden or open intervention, subsidies, market barriers, and so on. He goes back where the Comecon used to be, the old Soviet-led system, in which was based on the balancing of trade. Of course, he would like even surplus, but a minimum to achieve a balanced trade. And for him, this is the way to see the success. And this is what happens these days. While the EU tries to work for the restoration of the WTO, Trump goes and his people go one by one to the large trade partners, and they put them under threats to renegotiate or even give up earlier agreements and rights and modify them according to the wishes of the US. This has happened already with NAFTA. The new agreement is a very strange animal, let's put it that way. This has happened with South Korea. This is going on these days with Japan. And last but not least, the EU is also in a very difficult negotiations with the US. And it is probably only a question of time. We don't know how much time when the US will decide that the agreement which was negotiated last summer between himself, Trump, and President Juncker about restarting some partially the defunct TTIP transatlantic negotiations, but only partially, whether here the US will refrain from going ahead with its threats and to introduce new tariffs on the top of the already existing illegal, I emphasize, illegal tariffs, which were introduced for steel and aluminium against most countries of the world, except for those with whom the US had a bilateral agreement. And very briefly...
Let's keep China for the next round.
Okay. Okay, then I stop here.
Yeah. So please, Ettore.
Good afternoon, everybody. I must say, first of all, that it's an honor and a pleasure to be here, and many thanks to the organizer for this invitation. If you agree, I will try to concentrate just on two issues of the three you mentioned, particularly the prospect of reform of the WTO, and then try to give a very preliminary answer to the question whether we are facing a structural change in US policy, trade policy or not, which of course requires to look at the long-term factors, in a sense, which is not an easy exercise. What is clear is, as we know, that the WTO is almost in a state of paralysis that its very future is now at stake, and this applies to all three main functions or pillars of the organization, so not only the negotiating function, but also compliance monitoring and, of course, dispute settlement, so the arbitration function. But I fully agree with the ambassador when he underlined that the structural deficiencies became evident well before Trump came to power and started implementing unilateral protectionist policies, and also directly criticizing or assaulting the WTO as such. But the problem is that because of these restrictive measures that have been implemented by the US and not only by the US, we are now facing a sort of vicious circle, because in a sense these measures are partially taken because the WTO is in a sense in the state of paralysis, but the current inability of the WTO to face and to counter those measures may be taken as another proof that it is irrelevant. So we are in this very difficult situation. Are there is there good news? We can speak of positive development. In a sense, one can perhaps be too optimistic, but it's positive in any case that now, compared with perhaps 1 or 2 years ago, there is now a widespread recognition that the WTO is in need of reform, and many member countries have submitted many proposals. So optimistically, one can say that in a sense now we are in a growing moment for reform, although, as I will say in a moment, the structural obstacles are very serious. We have several important initiatives, one led by Canada, which aims at particularly, it's a sort of bottom-up initiative aimed at creating a sort of consensus around a set of reform proposals. And then we have also an initiative by the European Commission, is a concept paper, which was issued some months ago, which I think has some relevance because it covers a wide range of issues and try to be comprehensive, and perhaps in the second round I will come back on that. Not to be underestimated in this effort, so-called trilateral initiative between EU, US and Japan, which try within the framework of the WTO to particularly address pending issues with China concerning, for instance, the forced technology transfer, the industrial subsidies, but also, for instance, cyber espionage and others. This has led some analysts to dream of a possible prospect of a coalition of like-minded countries or market economies countries forge a sort of create a common front to induce China to make concession. As a matter of fact, at this point we need to underline in any case, China is not delivering on the promises it made when it joined the WTO, and this is a real problem. And so we Europeans could be interested in seeing whether this initiative can have some impact. The hope is that the next summit of the G20, which will take place in Japan, can start discussing in earnest this problem of reform of the WTO after having recognized that this is a real problem. This was trumpeted by Trump as one of its of his victory last time the G20 met. We know, on the other hand, that the next ministerial meeting of the WTO will take place only next year, so in an election year, and this could be in the US, and this could be, of course, a complicating element. But that said, there are very more structural obstacles, which are certainly more serious than these signs of hope, which I mentioned. And the first is the fact that the organization is consensus-based organization, reaching an agreement between 164 countries to reform the structure, the institution, the modus operandi of the organization is extremely difficult. One example is, for instance, the EU and others are insisting on trying to change or to inject more flexibility, perhaps, in the distinction between developing countries and developed countries, since those labeled as developing countries are able to take some advantages and benefits, while the reality is that they have full capacity to take on the full obligation within the WTO. So this is a key point, but of course it is a very strong resistance from within from many countries in the WTO to accept this change. And then a second key element, which has been mentioned by the ambassador, there are strong divergences between the EU and US concerning many issues, including particularly the dispute settlement mechanism. And there is a real US ambiguity whether the current administration is really, in a way, committed to reforming the WTO or wants just to dismantle it, because it's still blocking the appointment, continue to block the appointment of the new, for instance, the new members of the appellate body, which is now leading the appellate body in for the dispute settlement to the point of paralysis, which can happen just by the end of this year. Just a final point concerning this, if the US current attitude regarding trade should be seen as a sort of new normal or long-term trend or not. Of course, there are some strong lobbies behind this policy, but much more important, this reflects a deep popular discontent about the dislocation effect of the liberalizing policies in trade, and this is, of course, one of the strongest bases of consensus for this policy. But I would also recall you that at the beginning, and then for some time, there was a strong division. There is still a strong division, even within the US administration, on trade policy. So the president was given, indeed, has been given different advice for the member of the economic team. This is an element to be considered, although we are now seeing that the Trump hardline is prevailing. And within the Republican Party, there is still, of course, a strong constituencies worried about the effect, especially in terms of disruption of the supply chain, which can be caused by these policies.
We'll stop you here.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Good. So the floor is yours, William.
Thank you. I will continue from strategic picture. So when we look at the trade war, it's according to the political economy theories, it's just a first sector when the global hegemon is becoming weaker and belief into the norm-based global order starts to disappear, then trade and currency wars are the ones which start first. And the word war here might be proper also in military terms in the future, because usually it goes the way that first you make your opponent poor and then you are able to attack him if you want. And in that sense, I think if we have this question of tactical approach to that, I think this is also showing how little we accept the problematic situation, because our challenge is not a tactical one. Our challenge is a strategic one. We have to admit that most of the other big players in the global arena are ready for conflict because they would benefit, they believe, from the conflict. They just are about to pick the time. So it's, for example, the Chinese are openly saying it's not time yet. So basically, they are still collecting what they need to collect. Is it technology? Is it money? Is it market positions? They are sneaking in with their technology. They are making us dependent by hoping that maybe the military conflict is not needed when you own your opponent already. And if you look also Americans, we have very similar values with them, also in terms of liberal trade, and we tend to believe, at least for decades, for the same things. And here I hope we don't have strategic clash. I hope when US president is changing, we can have a new good start. And so far we just need damage control in that matter. So basically to keep as much as possible not to go to war with them, because there are not too many left in the battlefield with whom we can actually go to alliance. And and with Russians, it's the economy size of Spain. So basically what makes it's very problematic is the decisiveness and agility, how they play against us with all the pipelines policy and money laundering and so on. So basically, in terms of scale, this is doable. About the nature of war, I think the hybrid nature is visible for everybody. It's not the same gentleman's competition what we believe we are participating. We all look very nice and we behave very polite, but our opponents are not democratic in most of the cases. They are not following the same norms. By cheating us, they can be proud about themselves sometimes. So it's when we visited with the Carlist China, I think we really saw how totalitarian this country is. And this is the first, if to invest somewhere, I think we need to invest to send more our officials to China, really to see that there is nothing to reform. It's fully corrupted and totalitarian. There is very little what you can do without, they call it Communist Party, but we didn't find anybody understanding what communism means there. It's just kind of corrupted or cartel-based society which is using the cheap labor and which is very strongly led by a certain group. And if we try to have a democratic response to that in tactical level or wherever we try, we are by far too slow, too heavy, too ignorant, too self-confident. Next, what we also can ask about us is, what are we ready to give away in that combat? Mostly what we have, two things which limit us. First, we have not only thousands, but hundreds of thousands regulations which do not allow us to be faster. We think it's a good thing, but this is one of the roots of the Brexit. What the British say, that every single directive or regulation itself might be good, but if you put them all together, it's too many of them. And it's very hard to stay in the global competition if you have to follow them. So basically, this is the big strategic question. Can we reverse this process to make us faster? And the second problem is, we have ethics and moral, which is quite often what we value the highest, but which makes us weak in that sense that, for example, we believe in open society. We believe that we should allow, if the Chinese and Russians mark their companies as private ones, they create five companies to hide Gazprom or Huawei somewhere, then we suddenly allow them in. Because we say, according to our rules, according to our moral, we are not turning like they. So they come in and they control the situation. And there is very little to do against it if we have allowed them in. And now this Huawei 5G generation coming, it might end up that in one moment they control all the informational systems what we have. So that's a problem what the Americans already have. And another part of that global competitiveness question is that the game is going in favor of the others. If we look at the economic growth or the debt ratio, then we are among the big players again not the one who scores. Every month ticks for the Chinese, and it's if Chinese have more than 6% growth, Americans have around 3, then European average will be around 1. So basically, delaying is not helping us at all. And to continue from this tactical question, I think also tactics will not help us. It will just make us feel better that we do something. And European response has always been to create some committee to talk about it, to create new rules, to finance 2% more. But the whole idea of trade is that it should make money to you. You should not subsidize it. The whole point is missed by that you, if you start subsidizing it, the whole game goes to the wrong direction. And we can have every kind of research and development committees established, and we can invest money to the higher education, but if that does not produce something what we can sell, what will bring us money and power, then it's just buying time. And this is in my vision what we do, buying time, while the Chinese and the Indians are buying real assets. So they can buy Nokia, they can buy Volvo, they can buy many others, they can buy the channel between Tallinn and Helsinki while we are building the last century technology railway. So basically, we have to admit, so the first maybe conclusion in that is status quo is not interesting for them, time is not ticking for us, and fine-tuning and tactical solutions are not helping us. What we need is a strategic decision that we treat them as opponents, like we started to do with Russians in certain moment, that we stop faking this naive face that there is a market economy in China. There is no. If you can find any, I would be happy, you can guide me where to see it. To go a little bit closer, the next crisis is definitely closer than the last one. So there will be next crisis. The last one, financial crisis, was not the last one in human history. So definitely we have survived the last one, but our competitors will use the next one like they used the last one to buy assets in Europe. And certain governments, especially Italian one, will be pressurized to sell something in open market, what we can call again open market, but it can be also, this auction can be participated by Chinese government, nicely hiding the traces. So we should prepare for that instead of hoping that the next crisis will not come. And of course, another value what we have to think how to follow it. European politics has been moving towards social democracy and, let's mildly say, some socialist principles of inclusion, youth employment, and so on. Unfortunately, with a cost of efficiency in that sense. Whatever I look also in Estonia, the European rules are making production more expensive by making it less competitive. And this is the question for the trade. In open market, nobody is putting the label that you did produce it with not moral or ethical ways. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. It was very interesting trio, but it seems to me that we can a bit extend this trio to the others, people in around this table. If you have immediate comment, please raise your hand. Carlos and then
Otis. Thank you, Carlos Bukowski, Latvian International Affairs. Thank you all four for wonderful presentations and thought-provoking comments. There's actually Villiers' comments on hopes that the new president, the new U.S. president, will get the free trade relations back on track actually made me think about two things. The first thing, are you completely sure that the new one will be whether Trump or not Trump, that this actually is going to happen? But I'm more curious about this whole current situation in relations between the United States and the European Union and the Juncker-Trump deal, or just the peace agreement for a while on trade relations. And the question is, if looking at how Trump eagerly went against the TTIP agreement, that is that is one thing. But the second thing is, of course, that his speeches and hopes more are aimed at having frictionless trade between the European Union and the United States. So, do you see that there is a possibility, if we see the Trump second term, that there will could be some kind of United States European Union free trade area, free trade agreement, in which I guess T would stand for Trump?
Well, everybody knows that
you introduce yourself.
Artis Lange, I'm a member of the parliament, yes, in Latvia. Everybody has read that the European Union, and not just America, has become very critical of China and is adopting an attitude that not to let Chinese companies come in, especially with regard to strategic objects. I know in Latvia we have about 6, 7, 8 strategic objects where they will not come near. But Wilbur, are you saying to me that Estonia is ignoring this trend and the Chinese are going to build a tunnel between Finland and Estonia?
Yes, I also heard about it. It's intention. Yeah. No, don't answer now. We have also one.
I am Roland Strebs, a former member of parliament and now candidate for European Parliament from New Conservative Party. That was very excellent presentation of all of you, of course, but I was highly impressed with your presentation, Viljar. You said response should be towards China, where you used your combat terms, yeah, like clash, war, yeah. I was hoping that you are using it in economic terms, yeah, that we were not speaking about military war, yeah. So, you said that we need strategic responses, yeah? But can you go a little bit further and maybe tell us what you think how those strategic responses should be designed, yeah? What is your vision? Mm-hmm. How it should look like this mm-hmm. economic or trade war with China?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. The last ambassador.
Ambassador of Italy here in Latvia. And I'm happy that I have an Italian expert here sitting at this table. Thank you for inviting him. I just wanted to mention, well, probably you read it in the press, that Italy was the first, I think, among the 27 member countries to sign a memorandum on the with China. Mm-hmm. On the Belt and Road Agreement. So my question is, of course, I think this affects also the trade. Mm-hmm. Will there be some reaction, according to you, from the European Commission? Is that agreement just fully acceptable to the European Commission? And it seems to me that if Italy, you know, starts taking this stance, it will be followed by others. So maybe is it too late for the European Union to speak with one voice and avoid actually that the Chinese become part of our economy anyways? I mean, because they're already entering through the Italian market or through other markets.
Okay, and now I think we can actually start in the opposite direction, Lydia. But be concise, we have 15 minutes only.
Yes, I will start with the easiest questions. First with IT's question about tunnel between Tallinn and Helsinki, which has been talked about a couple of years and which would make Rail Baltica more reasonable. Mm-hmm. What is interesting, Tallinn has been known as quite corrupted capital for many years, controlled by Central Party, still controlled by Central Party. They are having their different vision about what is corruption. And now the former, or actually the actual mayor of Tallinn, is about to become a minister of economy. it's not a bad joke, it's just a reality. So, and I think that would actually change it even to that side, that they will be going for the Chinese money, because what will stop them? So now the question is, European Commission and our Director General Hololei has been strongly against the Chinese hand in that game, and even ready to reject the tunnel. But there will be a big fight, and for the Chinese, this money is quite small, so they try to do whatever they can do to control it, and because they have reserves which they need to spend somewhere. About Carly's question, do I hope something to improve? It depends on the pressure also from the other sides. It's like, I think things will improve when Trump needs Europeans as allies. And when the Europeans start to understand it, I think it's also a little bit related with Brexit and where UK is landing between Europe and US. They also need to pick a side. They need some kind of solution. So I think when we need a crisis to agree on something. When the crisis comes, then we will be more ready. It will be painful, but it can happen then. If there is no crisis, and Trump will have very little benefit with signing with us, because we are not the growing economic. The train is going to the east, not to the west. In that sense, we're just a possible partner who can serve him for certain years. So this is also something what we need to admit with many other fields, that what is the added value for him? We are not making the game. We are just becoming more object than we would like to, like it was during the Cold War, that Europe was the playground, not a player in that game, because we didn't want to play. About strategic resources, I feel sometimes that it, especially for the high level officials, it is they are restricted by their time in office and rotation, and it's usually not a strategic vision what they need to be successful. So this is the question, that first we have to prioritize the strategic vision. It must be something what is, again, paying off to them if they create a strategic vision. We have to prioritize it. We have to admit the problem that the way how we react is too slow. It's whatever we try to run or walk a little bit faster, it's still not enough. And maybe two examples where I see we could start is, we should start to define certain red lines which we do not debate about Chinese. And trying to, because otherwise, it's like with the kids, they always challenge your red lines. And if it is visible that you are ready to debate the red lines, then the next red line will be debated when you are weaker. Like this Italian case shows that they have a lot of dedication and focus. So I think EU needs to start to provide certain red lines with the totalitarian competitors, that we do not do certain things with them, even if we do it inside. And one example would be the research and development sector. At the moment, as we play by our own openness rules, they can collect whatever they want, while we cannot collect anything from them. And there needs to be a strategic approach to that, how we stop it. Because otherwise, they are copying everything good what we have, while we cannot copy what they have. So we cannot win this competition. Mm-hmm. And so yeah.
Thank you.
First of all, two quick comments on what you said. You are essentially described our relations with China as one of strong ideological and strategic competition, and the need for us to respond to this challenge. What we should continue to ask ourselves if we have some leverage still on China. I think China continues to have an interest in preserving the current system to some extent. Okay, it's exploiting the system, but it's not in its ultimate interest to the destruction, the dismantlement of the. So there is some leverage we can use. I would also ask that I'm not sure that Italy is so eager to sell its assets. If you have followed the debate leading then to the signing up to this framework agreement, there were a heated debate, even within the government, a strong resistance, which will certainly reemerge in the future. Concerning the next presidential election, one factor that we need to consider is whether in the end, eventually, this policy of Trump will bear the expected results or not. Mm. This is it remains to be seen in terms of reducing the trade balance. We know that the trade deficit have other factor, macroeconomic factor, domestic factors, in particular the level of consumption and saving, and the policies that Trump is following, these expansionary policies, are leading to an even further increase in the deficit, so that now the deficit is projected to rise even this year, despite this protectionist measure. So this may perhaps even prompt a rethinking within the US. Concerning China, we should underline that indeed the US has a strong stake in the outcome of the US-China negotiation. In particular, we know that the US is pursuing two objectives that not necessarily are easily to are compatible. One is to induce China to open its economy, and the other is to get it buy more products. China, of course, made many promises concerning the second aspect in particular. But to deliver on those promises, implementing this project will require government order to state control enterprises to buy U.S. products, assuming that these are realistic promises, which in turn will lead to an even stronger control by the state on the Chinese economy. So, the EU, in principle, could be interested in this pressure on China by the U.S. to open its market. But if the main objective becomes just to sell more products to China, this may be counterproductive. Final point, another challenge is indeed the prospect of a new agreement, trade agreement with the US after the failure of TTIP. The position are quite distant, so of course nobody is optimistic, but I think that the EU should try to be even flexible in this. I think a modest progress, for instance, on agriculture issues can be considered. Of course, at the moment, the EU is resisting the idea of including agriculture, mm-hmm. and also some reciprocal concessions on the services sector. This is because, of course, in the longer term, an agreement with US would be particularly beneficial, perhaps to the have positive positive on the multilateral trade system.
Yeah. Thank you, Peter.
Well, I would speak about China because I couldn't cover it, and here I would start with the last question about Italy's situation. This is true that Italy was the first country of the G7, but if we are all aware that there is another initiative of the Chinese, the 16+1, and each of the countries represented each of the new member states, mm-hmm. plus the West Balkan countries, mm-hmm. signed it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's be somewhat also self-critical. Mm-hmm. And this was clearly a cover, or not even cover, to split the EU. Old member states, new member states. And why they signed it? Hoping for rather small money from the Chinese, some investment, mm-hmm. building something. And one should ask those countries who have participated already in this Belt and Road Initiative, Malaysia, what they received and how much they pay back, or Kazakhstan, who has ever seen any real development from Chinese projects. Everything is done by Chinese workers, Chinese machinery, and even Chinese material. And plus they take over the market, by the way, destroying the domestic industry. So let's not have any illusions. Now this leads to the second question, can China be reformed. I'm also skeptical because I am old enough to have lived in Hungary under the Gulag communism, which was at that time the most considered as the most reformist, and a lot of Chinese delegations came to study it, but even so, it was a one-party state. I think, based on my personal experience, that a one-party state, by definition, cannot become a market economy. Mm-hmm. It would be the end of it if the one-party control would stop. So therefore, whatever agreement finally, if and when Trump can sign, in this I agree with my colleague, it might be something to promise that we will buy more, and okay, that's all, but nothing fundamental change in the system. About the EU's possible strategies, because you asked that what are the EU's possibilities. First of all, just a few weeks ago, the Commission has put out the new China strategy, which is very late, but still starting the opening of the eyes to the new realities. I would propose whoever is interested to read and study it. It has very clearly tools grouped into 10 rather succinct points. But when it comes to trade and economic relations, then first of all, the US-type investment control, but it would need the cooperation of every member state, and this is not guaranteed. Because it might be that for money, or for simply because countries are forced, they would sell their assets irrespective what the European Commission advises or thinks about it. Another part of it, much stronger use of trade defense. I used to supervise the trade defense anti-dumping, anti-subsidy divisions of DG Trade, and it has come out clearly that their internal system is totally opaque. It is, one can never see what kind of support is given, not just by the central, but regional and local governments to the companies. And very often, the price of the final products is cheaper than the inputs. So, but this being said, still this can be used much more effectively, and only in this manner can the Chinese limit Chinese efforts can be limited. Finally, historical fact: we like it or not, China will be the largest economy in the world in about 10 to 12 years' time. Every forecast agrees with it, unless there is a sudden collapse. But this is not to be expected because the under President Xi, they do everything possible to control the present situation, and I don't see much sign of a really strong pushback from the Chinese population. That means that China, not in per capita, but the size of their GDP, will be the largest again, as was the case about 1,000 years ago, will be again the largest country or largest economy of the world. This situation we cannot forget about it, and the only chance is if the EU and the US can find a way to work together. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. Immediate comment? No. Okay, in 2 minutes, even in 1 minute, I have to summarize the outcome of our session. First of all, thank you very much to all three speakers for very encouraging and inspiring and intelligent interventions. And thank you for everybody who came to this session. Just to answer the fundamental question of the session in one sentence, I think that strategic role of the European Union should be to prevent this trade war to the extent possible to prevent war. How to do it? I fully agree that this is not a question of tactic, but also the question of strategy and strategical decision. But this strategy very much depends on the geopolitical actors on the situation. It's not just one-size-fits-all approach. It depends, and it should be quite flexible. Definitely, the European Union should try to keep alive these TTIP attempts, even if it will not happen tomorrow or the day after. But whenever the situation will be favorable, and the European Commission should put on the table this draft agreement. I must say that EU have made already a lot to sign different bilateral trade agreement with a number of countries. After Canada, it will follow by Japan, and in the pipeline there are plenty of, and this is sort of strategic signals to the same United States that they should also follow the other countries. As to China, look, Latvia and Estonia and also Hungary indeed are in this 16+1, but Italy is much bigger country, and that's why already the reaction of the European Commission was negative. I don't think that there is a special instrument to prevent countries from signing whatever bilateral agreement, but then it's also up to the countries or members of the EU to think about not only national but also European interests, to somehow to find this compromise. Well, and I think that as to WTO, I hope that we will continue to live in multilateral system, because as we with Carlos heard at one recent seminar, multilateral trade is much better than spaghetti ball of bilateral agreements. Okay, so let's hope that also WTO will be kept alive, despite all difficulties and challenges and so on. Okay, thank you very much for your attention, and enjoy the rest of our conference.